Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Wednesday, May 4th, 2016. Last night in Indiana, voters sealed the deal for Donald Trump, and we enter the weird zone.
I want to be a billionaire so fucking bad. Buy all of the things I never had. I want to be on the cover of Forbes magazine.
He's on the cover of all the magazines.
Next to Oprah and the Queen. Oh, every time I close my eyes.
So do we pick the billionaire or the dynasty politician? Those are the choices being advanced by the mainstream media and the political establishment in this country. Let's take a look. Donald Trump cinched the deal last night, and in short order, Ted Cruz announced he's out. And today, I think it's about to occur in the next hour or so, John Kasich is going to throw in the towel on his presidential campaign as well. That leaves Trump as the last man standing, and he will sweep the remaining primaries and clinch the Republican nomination. So this is the first non-politician who will be nominated to run for a major party since Dwight Eisenhower back in 1952. And it is a real rush off the cliff. The lemmings are in control at this point. And it is really sad and tragic to see the American electorate respond to this doofus who doesn't really articulate clear positions. Just a lot of emotional commentary and his limited vocabulary that things are either fabulous or a disaster. And with his disapproval numbers in the 70% range among women, and Hillary Clinton's disapproval numbers among men not quite that high, this is going to be a polarizing election where sex, that's often referred to politely as gender, but sex, and not sexual behavior, is going to be, I think, the big driver. So it's going to be a very bizarre campaign cycle as it continues. I heard Donald Trump last night trying to be more presidential. He said nice things about Ted Cruz now that Ted is out of the race. And in a moment, I'll mention all the nasty things that Ted finally unloaded with on Trump yesterday as he prepared to hit the exit with Carly Fiorina. But the bizarre thing last night was to hear him talk about coal miners and how he wants to bring the industry back. And I watched some of the late-night coverage on the Fox News channel, and I was just, I had to do a reality check because one of the goons there said, well, you know, if you drive a Tesla, that's a coal car. And to a certain extent, that's true. If you live in West Virginia, the electricity that you use to charge your Tesla batteries came from a coal-fired power plant. But these people blow right past all of the issues of dirty air, global warming, and the other toxic side effects of using coal for energy. And they talked about revitalizing an industry that is on life support. And the value of the coal industry was in the $60 billion range 8 years ago. It's now worth about $5 billion. And it's not the free market causing people to use less coal. It is government regulation and the concerns about climate change. And so Trump is oblivious to all that. It's all about winning and making America great. And his promises about bringing back manufacturing jobs in this country are simply pie in the sky. The idea that he can reverse these trends because he's such a great deal maker and he'll intimidate the other parties around the world, it's just ridiculous. So with Trump securing the nomination, the Republicans have a real problem on their hands. It is likely to cost them control of the Senate, and that is mildly encouraging. I don't see any possibility that the House, where so many seats are gerrymandered, will flip back to Democratic control. But the Senate, it is possible, I think, technically, for the Democrats to win 5 or 6 seats, with Trump really being the toxic leader of the party's ticket. So what did Ted Cruz finally say? I mean, it's fascinating to see how for months he was kissing the Donald's ass every chance he got. Then he kind of went into neutral mode as he became a factor and Trump began to attack him as Lion Ted. And then, of course, there are these the National Enquirer expose of Ted's paramours, alleged paramours. And then recently, the National Enquirer, which Trump picked up on yesterday morning, the day of the Indiana primary, published this picture allegedly tying Ted Cruz's father to Lee Harvey Oswald and the Kennedy assassination. I mean, Cruz just got chewed up and spit out by Donald Trump. And so, as he knew that the end was, well, just hours away, in Indiana yesterday, he told reporters, Cruz did, I'm going to do something I haven't done for the entire campaign. I'm going to tell you what I really think of Donald Trump. This man is a pathological liar. He doesn't know the difference between truth and lies. He lies with practically every word that comes out of his mouth. And in a pattern that I think is straight out of a psychology textbook, his response is to accuse everybody else of lying. Now, Ted Cruz is quite a liar himself. So, it takes one to know one. He went on to call Trump a narcissist at, quote, a level I don't think this country has ever seen. Donald Trump is such a narcissist that Barack Obama looks at him and goes, dude, what's your problem? He went on to call Trump utterly amoral, said he believes that Trump fits the textbook definition of a pathological liar. And once again, I'd say it takes one to know one. Quote, I say pathological because I think if you hooked him up to a lie detector test, he could say one thing in the morning, one thing at noon, and one thing in the evening, all contradictory, and he'd pass the lie detector test each time. Whatever lie he's telling at that minute, he believes it. He also called Trump a bully, and I agree with this. His aggressive tendencies come from a deep, yawning cavern of insecurity. And a final quote from Ted Cruz, and this may be the last time I ever quote him, I hope so. There's a reason Donald Trump builds giant buildings and puts his name on them everywhere he goes. And I'll say there are millions of people in this country who are angry, angry at Washington, angry at politicians who have lied to them. I understand that anger. I share that anger. And Donald is cynically exploiting that anger, and he is lying to his supporters. Well, a lot of that can be written off as sour grapes from Ted Cruz. But it's also a moment of real honesty. Or at least as close to honest as Ted Cruz can muster. Now, on the Democratic side, it was a bit of a surprise that Bernie Sanders bested Hillary Clinton by 5 percentage points. It was hard to call Indiana. They have rules against robocalls and telephone polling, laws, actually, in the state. And so the polling was very weak, and that's why nobody was really sure what the turnout would be and what the outcome would be. And to be fair, the Clinton campaign stood down. Hillary only made one visit to Indianapolis, and they didn't spend any money on TV ads in Indiana because they think they've got it wrapped up. But the exit polling shows that remarkable number of more than half of Democrats do not consider Clinton honest and trustworthy. And after closing the gap with blue-collar white voters in parts of the Northeast last week, she lost them by 30 points in Indiana. And she also suffered with self-identified independents. 73% of those backed Sanders. Now, keep that in mind, because in a moment, I've got some polling information that has been spun up to make it look like Clinton is going to walk away with California. And those independents are the critical difference that was understressed in the poll that I'll cite in a couple of minutes. Now, Bernie went on the offensive and said in his victory acceptance, I understand that Secretary Clinton thinks that this campaign is over. I've got some bad news for her. Tonight, we won a great victory in Indiana. Next week, we are going to be in West Virginia. We think we have a real shot to win in that great state. Then we're going to Kentucky and we're going to Oregon, and we think we have a pretty good chance to win there as well. We feel great tonight, not only winning here in Indiana and accumulating some more delegates, but gaining the momentum we need to take us to the finish line, which he described as an uphill battle. Now, in all the coverage, as I've been pointing out repeatedly, and I hope it's not annoying to you that I repeat this, but the corporate media keeps saying that Sanders does not have a path to win the nomination. And I believe that is generally accurate. With the superdelegates that Clinton has racked up, his path is very, very difficult. But he can deny her the nomination on the first ballot and throw it into a contested convention. And while the network people last night were so disappointed that there's not going to be a food fight at the Republican convention, they don't mention that Sanders is gearing up to try to deny Clinton that first ballot nomination. And it is technically possible. But the spinmeisters are so busy trying to convince most Americans, and I think they are succeeding to a troubling degree, that he simply doesn't have it, can't do it, and he ought to go back to Vermont and take a nap. But a couple of days ago on Monday, Politico published an investigative piece written by Kenneth Vogel and Isaac Arnsdorf. And they investigated what is called the Hillary Victory Fund. And this is something that the Clinton campaign has been bragging about, that they're raising money for state parties and down-ticket races because she is such a stalwart of the Democratic Party. Now, let's be fair here. Barack Obama didn't lift a finger or donate a dime or raise money for any other candidate for most of the time that he was running for president, certainly not in 2008, to a limited degree in 2012. And he went through the motions in 2014 in a couple of races. But the Clinton campaign says that, while it's gross that we can raise $350,000 from a single individual or a couple in one fundraiser, that money is only $2,700 goes to the Clinton campaign, and all the rest goes to the Democratic National Committee and state party committees. But Politico reports that of the $61 million raised so far by the Hillary Victory Fund, less than 1% has been transferred to state coffers and left there. They transfer it to the states and immediately transfer it to the DNC. It is a money laundering scheme, pure and simple. And it also is part of the catnip that secures the support of many of these superdelegates. In 32 states last year, the Clinton campaign made deals that will share this money with you. Only they're not. And what happens is that money is donated to the Victory Fund, then it is transferred to state committees, and immediately then transferred to the DNC or to committees that independently support Hillary Clinton's campaign. So this skirts, if not violates, the campaign laws. And it is partly enabled by the Supreme Court's McCutcheon decision, which blew the lid off the limits on individual contributions in a given cycle. That's how George Clooney or one of the Walmart heirs can donate $350,000 to the Hillary Victory Fund. Now, the Sanders campaign has been, I think, pretty passive about this. There's an email that I got yesterday that was posted on Facebook. The email originated from Jeff Weaver of the Sanders campaign. But this is a really serious set of issues, and it plays to Bernie Sanders' strengths, that he's the one who is being funded by $27 contributions from individuals, not by $350,000donations from superstars or the ultra-wealthy. So I'm linking to this story from Politico, and I encourage you to read it and see how this worked. Here's an example. In Minnesota, the Democratic Farmer Labor Party got $43,500 from the Victory Fund on November 2nd. On November 2nd, the transfer occurred from the Farmer Labor Party's account of $43,500 to the Democratic National Committee. And the pattern repeated in another transaction on between December and January. And the Sanders campaign is accusing them of laundering this money in the following way. They use the example if Alice Walton, an heir to the Walmart fortune, gave $350,000, the first $33,000 is supposed to go to the DNC. But that is not what's been happening. They took that money and spent it on advertisements and small-dollar fundraising solicitations. Then they take all of those small-dollar contributions and the data and transfer it directly to the Clinton campaign. It's a way for them to benefit from a contribution much larger than the limit, the legal limit, from Alice Walton, The next step, they take Alice Walton's money and transfer it to state parties, who then immediately transfer it to the DNC. Oftentimes, they do it without the state party even knowing it, because the Clinton campaign controls all of the bank accounts involved. And so this is a very serious issue, and it deserves much more attention. Also, the email issues that Hillary Clinton supporters say are nothing, it's just a lot of bullshit, forget about it. I mean, I see this on Facebook every day. Well, today, the judge in one of the lawsuits brought by Judicial Watch has set up a plan over the next 8 weeks to take sworn depositions from former aides to Secretary Clinton, and has left open the question of whether Clinton will be subject to a deposition herself. So the individuals include her chief of staff, Cheryl Mills, and Huma Abedin. But most importantly, it includes Brian Pagliano. He is the information technology specialist who, we believe, set up the server. And he has already asserted the Fifth Amendment in his deposition or interrogation by the FBI, and he has declined to cooperate with a Senate inquiry into the matter. So he got an immunity deal. And it will be interesting to see how all this plays out. The schedule is that these depositions will be completed by the end of June, meaning that this story, this issue, this vulnerability of Hillary Clinton's will be in play in early July as the conventions get underway. So I think it's a very serious issue, and those who dismiss it are doing so for political and emotional reasons. And the judge ruled, Judicial Watch raises significant questions in its motion for discovery about whether the State Department processed documents in good faith in response to the FOIA request, and Judicial Watch is therefore entitled to discovery. Critical facts related to the ClintonEmail.com server preclude a legal analysis at this time of whether the State Department conducted an adequate search under FOIA. And it finally noted the judge's statement that when the State Department took possession of emails from Clinton and Huma Abedin, that Clinton and Abedin and Cheryl Mills got to decide which emails were returned to the State Department. And the judge finds that to be a very curious process. And speaking of the developments, I want to recommend an op-ed published at The Guardian today by my friend Thomas Frank. He dropped by on his book tour promoting Listen Liberal last month. He was also on Bill Maher's show Friday night. I don't know if you got to catch him. Anyway, his piece is a question. The headline is, "Why must the Trump alternative be self-satisfied, complacent Democrats?" And he notes that many Americans have not recovered from the economic meltdown in 2008, but that the ruling class and the Democratic Party establishment, well, they're feeling pretty good. And he says they are disassociated from the mood of the nation, and they don't care. He says Hillary Clinton is more or less openly offering herself as the complacency candidate, the least inspiring front runner in many years. She is a dynastic heir who stands to receive the Democratic nomination largely because it's her turn. Clinton has scolded her rival for wanting to break up Wall Street banks, since such a policy wouldn't also end racism and sexism. You get the point there? She keeps expanding the mandate and suggesting that just breaking up the banks wouldn't be enough. And that, of course, is a very empty rhetorical effort on her part. He goes on to say that he refers to the establishment Democrats as kind of country club Democrats. And we used to think of country clubs and Republicans as the connector there. So it's a very interesting piece, and I encourage you to read it. Tom Frank is a very bright guy who I have a lot of respect for. Now, to the coverage of recent polls. I'm holding in my hand an article from The Hill. That's the political website in Washington, D.C. And the headline reads, "Sanders trails Clinton by double digits in California." Now, that statement is narrowly true if the polling is only focused on members of the Democratic Party. And by the way, I just signed up for the Democratic Party. I don't need to vote in the primary, but I did it so I could vote for a Bernie delegate to the convention. But more than when you add in the independents here in California, called no party preference, Sanders beats Clinton in that category by 15 points. Now, the numbers of registrants in the Democratic Party and those who have no party preference are a couple of percentage points apart. Democrats, outrank the so-called independents by 2 or 3%. But if we just consider them roughly comparable, then the 10 points that Clinton leads Sanders in among Democrats evaporates when you add the 15% margin he has with independents. And not only that, there are more than 700,000 people in California who have registered to vote in the last 4 months. And most of those are Democrats. The interesting thing is that independents in California can go to the polls or contact the registrar and say, I want to vote on the Democratic ballot, and they're given one. So independents have access to the Democratic primary, but not to the Republican primary in California. And so this is really an unhelpful spin. And it is pro-Clinton in the headline, and the article tends to back it up. But it doesn't include the real universe of voters who will be available to Sanders and Clinton on June 7th. And also, the latest CNN ORC national poll excludes Bernie Sanders. Now, I'm sure they asked about Sanders and matched him up with Trump, but the coverage that I picked up from CNN here just completely excludes Sanders, because the wizards at CNN have concluded that Hillary will be the Democratic nominee, and why bother with the pesky details of including Sanders in a poll when we, the people at CNN, have decided that he can't win? And again, he does not have to clinch the nomination in order to deny Clinton the nomination and throw the convention wide open. But we don't get to talk about that, do we? Today I'm releasing to subscribers a fresh interview in my Processing Distortion podcast series that appears at Boiling Frogs Post, and we're also going to release it at peterbcollins.com. My guest this week is Sibel Edmonds, the founder and publisher of Boiling Frogs Post, and she has provided the most accurate and courageous coverage of the true dimensions of the Dennis Hastert scandals, and the corporate media has completely ignored them. And as I've pointed out, this has cemented the limited hangout cover-up, which suggests that Dennis Hastert only buggered little boys or teenage boys when he was a wrestling coach in Illinois in the 70s. And we know it's flatly untrue. But it is completely blacked out from the media coverage, and we don't even know if the judge who sentenced Dennis Hastert and referred to him repeatedly as a serial child molester knows the full dimensions. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Sibel Edmonds.
The mainstream media has been sitting on this story since 2005, 2006, when I came out and exposed or attempted to expose Dennis Hastert as a corrupt criminal Speaker of the House representative, and the fact that all his criminal deeds, and those include also his serial pedophilic activities, mm-hmm. were known, monitored, recorded, filed by at least by two agencies in the United States, both the FBI and the CIA. And yet, even with this development, with the judge's ruling, when I get people sending me emails or contacting me, asking me if I feel vindicated, I have to say no, not at all. It doesn't even come close to that. Just take this whole portion of what the judge stated, and that is based on all the evidence he has seen and heard on Dennis Hastert. He uses the term serial pedophile. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the first things people need to know is, or do, is pause and say, when you're a serial pedophile, do you engage in all these pedophilic activities and then suddenly stop for 20 or 30 years?
I'll be releasing the interview with Sibel Edmonds today at peterbcollins.com, at iTunes, TuneIn, Spreaker, every other outlet, including the Peter B. Collins app. And I invite you to check it out. With Sibel, we also talk about NewsBud. And you may recall, back on Valentine's Day, we launched a crowdfunding campaign to build a new independent media outlet supported entirely by individuals of the public. And we didn't succeed in reaching our lofty goal, but we got almost $200,000 in pledges. So this Sunday, Mother's Day, we are going to launch a new Kickstarter campaign. And we've lowered the threshold to $150,000. We've changed our business model, and it's detailed in the Kickstarter campaign. And we also are going to begin production of NewsBud news coverage in June. So I'm excited about this. I believe it's well within our grasp, and I hope that you will be keeping an eye out for that and support us with the new NewsBud Kickstarter launch coming up this Sunday. Well, to me, putting aside all of the drama and the theatrics of the U.S. political campaign for president, the big story today is that a 28-year-old active-duty Army officer who is in the thick of the war against the Islamic State, he is an intelligence officer stationed in Kuwait, and his name is Nathan Michael Smith. And he has filed a lawsuit against President Obama over the legality of that war that he's fighting. Now, he doesn't want to run away from it. He says that his conscience requires him to demand that the president uphold the Constitution. He made an oath to defend the Constitution as a military officer, and he said, "To honor that oath, I'm asking the court to tell the president that he must get proper authority from Congress under the War Powers Resolution to wage the war against ISIS in Iraq and Syria." Hooray! This is a remarkable statement and a bold move by a rank-and-file officer. It exposes the abdication by the Congress of its critical role in war powers. And while the president claims that the blank check that the Congress gave Bush after 9/11 and that the authorization to invade Iraq somehow gives the authority to conduct the war in Syria and Iraq today, well, it doesn't hold up to careful scrutiny or to legal scrutiny. But that is the claim that the president makes. They also lamely say, well, look, Congress is providing all the money for this war, so they must support it. But that's not the same as an explicit declaration of war where Congress sets the parameters and gives the president the authority under the Constitution. And my big concern is that next year, whether it's a President Clinton or a President Trump, and I still would hope for a President Sanders, but I'm a realist here, okay? I have grave concerns about how they would use the powers that have been allowed to Barack Obama without explicit congressional action. And so I'm thankful to the Army captain who has brought that lawsuit. Yesterday, I told you about the American Navy SEAL who was killed near Mosul, Iraq, the third American killed since we went back into Iraq. And I learned today that the man who died was Charlie Keating IV. And perhaps you've heard me talk about the Keating family over the years. Charlie Keating Jr. was in the St. Xavier High School class of 1941, along with my father. And when I went to St. X, because my dad made me, Charlie Keating III was in the class right behind me. And they called him C3 and Charlie Keating Jr. They all got wrapped up in the Lincoln Savings and Loan scam, and Charlie went to prison for a while, the senior did. Well, the namesake, the grandson of Charles Keating Jr., is the Navy SEAL who died in Iraq yesterday. John Kerry, the Secretary of State, has made another bizarre move. He has announced that Bashar al-Assad, the dictator of Syria, has until August the 1st to clear out. He said the transition is coming. The target date is the 1st of August. So either something happens in these next few months, or they're asking for a very different track. Now, we don't know what that track really means. But Kerry has been saying this for years. Back in 2011, he said Assad's days were numbered. Well, it's a pretty high number. And what is so bizarre here, and I feel silly in having to detail part of this, but I don't support Bashar al-Assad. But the idea that we can throw him out of office and defeat the Islamic State and put some sort of a puppet government in power in Damascus that would be friendly to the United States, that is just a crackpot dream. And so I don't know what drives Kerry to make these kinds of threats and set a deadline for Assad, but it's pretty meaningless drivel, in my humble opinion. On Monday at the Supreme Court, the justices turned away an appeal from California challenging our death penalty system, and it produced a renewed broadside against the death penalty by Justice Stephen Breyer. And he said that more California death row inmates die by suicide than have been executed by the state. And he basically says that it conflicts with the Eighth Amendment, that it is cruel and unusual punishment. And he said that death row exonerations now are so frequent, evidence shows that innocent people have been executed, that death sentences were imposed arbitrarily, and that the capital justice system is warped by racial discrimination and politics. But Justice Thomas was unmoved. He said it's the fault of the death row plaintiffs for continuing their appeals. In Israel yesterday, a court sentenced the ringleader of the grisly crime of 2014, in which 16-year-old Palestinian Mohammed Abu Qadir was kidnapped, taken to a forest, he was choked, he was beaten unconscious, and ultimately this ringleader, whose name is Yosef Ben David, they set the young man afire and killed him. Well, the court ruled that, number one, he was competent to stand trial. They rejected his insanity appeal. And they sentenced Ben David, who's 31 years old, to life plus 20 years in prison. That's pretty rare justice coming from an Israeli court. A couple of quickies here. There's much more news than I can fit in today, so I'll just mention. Last week we told you about the real hazard of a nuclear event on the West Coast is the Hanford nuclear site that occupies a huge swath of Washington State in the eastern portion. And in the last few days, six more workers have been hospitalized for exposure to radioactive fumes leaking from these hundreds of tanks of radioactive waste on the site. And that brings the total number of workers affected in recent weeks to 26. I got a notice from Volkswagen because I drive a 2007 Passat wagon. It's not a diesel, but it turns out that I've got a Takata airbag in the driver's side. And Takata, of course, is the company that has recalled 35 million plus airbags that need to be fixed because they can explode and injure the driver, and of course, if it happens while you're driving, the consequences can be severe. The real concern now is that Takata may not be financially able to survive, and they're looking for some angels to take it over. Here in California, an important court victory because the Federal Department of Justice has dropped its lawsuits and its criminal complaints against the Harborside Medical Marijuana Health Center in Oakland, California. This is an important step forward because what happened was in 2012, Melinda Hogg, the U.S. attorney here, apparently to assist the reelection efforts of Barack Obama, launched a crackdown on all the state legal medical dispensaries of marijuana across California. But the biggest and most muscular is Harborside, which is run by a guy named Steve D'Angelo. Steve has been a guest on our program. You can look him up in the search window at peterbcollins.com. But they have won this battle, and I'm very pleased to see it. Also, we learned today that signature gatherers have succeeded in raising enough signatures to pass to get an initiative on the ballot this coming November, which would legalize marijuana completely. And finally, it was 46 years ago today, at Kent State University in Ohio, when anti-war protesters were surrounded by Ohio National Guardsmen, who were then ordered to shoot. Four of those student protesters were killed. One of them was named Allison Krauss, and she continues to be honored by her surviving sister, Laurel Krauss, who lives here in California and who's a friend on Facebook, and we've spoken a few times. I would like to honor those who protested the Vietnam War, those who risked their lives, and those like Allison Krauss, who lost their lives. We'll never forget.
Soldiers and Nixons.